This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on December 23rd, 2013. It's the Christmas edition, and today's guest is a repeat guest, Rob Eisenberg. We've talked to him at least three times in the past about his various frameworks and things that he's working on, and today we're going to revisit his Durandal framework. Rob, can you give us a quick overview of Durandal for anyone that hasn't heard of it before?
Sure, and thank you for having me on the show. Well, Durandal is an open source JavaScript library focused on creating rich client applications. These are typically called single-page applications, and they're on the rise. You're probably seeing more and more of them. A common example that a lot of people are familiar with is Gmail. It's this idea of a full, rich application experience that's delivered inside of a single HTML page, essentially. So Durandal makes it easy to build those kind of apps and to do so in a way that's elegant and allows you to write clean code. Of course, you can also write mobile apps and desktop apps with Durandal as well.
And I see it pop up everywhere. I know a lot of people are interested in this framework. You've been going at it for a while. What's the new news about Durandal?
So we had a bunch of releases this year, two major releases. Actually, we had our 1.0 release in the first quarter this year, and then we did a 2.0 release a few months ago. And you know, with each of these major releases, we just do massive improvements in terms of making the APIs nicer and making things easier to use, more consistent, and so on and so forth. Right now, we're working on version 2.1, which is just going to add some additional features around scenarios that people are encountering in the real world. And patch up some, always doing bug fixes and things like that. The big thing right now is that we are running a Kickstarter to fund further development over the next year, as well as a number of other things around the open source project that will help it to thrive long term and help us to look to the future.
So one question always with a Kickstarter, it's time limited, right? So when does this go until?
January 10th at 9:45 a.m. Eastern Time. So we got about 17 days to go as of the recording of this podcast.
Yeah, and we'll get this out really quick because of that. So, and then you've got, like every Kickstarter, you've got different contribution amounts as well.
Right. So there's a range of reward levels, and a lot of the reward levels. Pretty much all of them involve one of the main goals of the Kickstarter, which is to produce some comprehensive video training materials. So there's three different courses that we want to produce. Each is a separate application that we want to build from scratch. Each app will teach you quite a bit about Durandal, but also a bunch of just general things about UI architecture and organizing large-scale JavaScript client apps and things like that. There's different reward tiers. At the bottom level, you get, one of those video courses. As you go up, you get two courses and then three courses. And then there's a number of other insider things that you get access to the source code for those sample apps immediately. So before we even have time to produce the videos, we'll give you the source code to those apps. So if you want to just jump in and use it as a template, for example, for an app you want to build. So as you go up the line, you get early access to things like that, insider access to a private blog and monthly webcast where I'll be sharing with the insiders about work that's being done, not just on the training, but on future releases, tooling, and some next generation work that we're doing as well. And as you go up and up, there's other rewards in terms of even things like a virtual conference, for example, a full day, 8 hours live training virtually with you, your company, and 300 developers you want to invite or something like that. So we've got a number of different tiers if you're coming at it from a business perspective too, some marketing opportunities and different things like that as well.
So jumping ahead just a little bit, there was an interesting question from Cameron McFarland on Twitter. Wanted to know why you're going to use a Kickstarter for this, which is a developer tool, rather than an end product.
All right. So there's a whole bunch of different business models that open source projects tend to use, and a lot of projects tend to use a combination of different models in order to maintain themselves long term. And so I've gone down the road of doing a couple of things so far. One is we offer commercial support. We also have corporate sponsorships And so this is just another sort of a kind of a sponsorship opportunity through crowdsourcing. And the benefit of this is that everything in the Kickstarter is really designed around me focusing development on the core of Durandal itself and the necessary training and materials that need to be there in order for it to be successful long term. Another model around open source is to have an open source toolkit or library, and then to have a separate commercial product that either is built with it or augments it, or just uses it or something like that, and you sell that product in order to, you know, make a living, and then you do the open source as well. And that's a viable model, and that's something that we may do in the future as well. But the problem with that is that now you've got two products to develop, maintain, document, market, etc., instead of one. And only one of them is actually generating direct money to keep you in business. So the idea behind the Kickstarter really is that it's entirely focused on Durandal itself and important things around Durandal itself. So if that succeeds, that will fund the business for at least a year to put full-time resources on the project, and also to provide opportunities to launch other business models that could continue to sustain it long term. You know, for example, even the training we produce as part of the Kickstarter, all the Kickstarter backers get it immediately, but then we can turn around and sell that training at a slightly higher price, and that can sustain the project longer term. That training I don't necessarily see as a separate product entirely, because it's really essential to the framework, because without those kind of materials, it's really hard for something like this to stick around. But, you know, with that, basically, this is, you know, it's a Kickstarter in the real sense, which is about not just funding the project for the next year and not just these specific goals for backers, but also kickstarting the whole business around it and giving it a little bit of a sort of, you know, that injection of goodness at the beginning in order to give us the opportunity to put some other things in motion that will continue to allow the business around it to thrive in the future. And it's possible that, you know, that may result in a commercial product as well at some point. A Kickstarter like this would certainly give us the flexibility also to do that, or at least to get a start on something like that for the future.
Very good. So I want to ask you about where Durandal's headed and some of the things that you plan on building this year. But before we even get to that, maybe, could we talk a little bit about the developer experience as it exists today and how things work, and a little more detail about what's inside of there? I know working with Caliber and Micro in the past with Silverlight, it was very oriented towards making it easy to compose things together, view models with views and views inside of other views and so forth.
Right. So Durandal takes a lot of those kind of inspirations as well and tries to reinterpret them in the world of HTML and JavaScript. I'm really focused on composition, being able to enable developers to break things down into small manageable pieces and then declaratively compose them back together again. So Durandal has all those kinds of capabilities, and it tries to make it real simple by having a thin layer of conventions. You know, so for example, you can have, you know, customer list JS and customer list HTML, and the framework understands that those are two halves of the same component, so to speak, one that has the behavior and the other one that has the view. And so it will automatically require them both, connect them together through data binding, and push them into the HTML page, optionally animating the transition and all kinds of things like that. But the idea being that you basically can just drop files in and it works. And if you're writing a navigation app, of course, you'll map some routes like you would with most MVC frameworks. But beyond that, the composition engine takes over with this simple notion of conventions that allows it to stitch things together for you. And it just keeps it really simple. The idea is to be internally self-consistent as much as possible. So Durandal has widgets, and Durandal has modal dialogues and things like this, but you build them the same way that you build any screen component. You follow the same pattern of creating a JavaScript module, creating an HTML view, following the simple naming convention. And the only difference is, you know, you ask the modal dialog system to display it, or you use the widget system to display it versus the normal composition system. But under the covers, all those things are built on the same core and understand the same developer patterns. So basically, when you learn how to do one thing in Durandal, it's a very short step to do other things. And so that's where it's all, the way it is kind of internally right now. You write your code in modules using AMD as the standard module pattern. And then you build JavaScript objects and you write HTML and you use data binding expressions to connect them together. We're built on top of three core libraries: Require.js, which provides our module system, Knockout, which provides our data binding system, and then jQuery, which basically provides the browser abstraction to more easily manage cross-browser issues. And then Durandal just stitches those things together in an opinionated way and lets you use these simple patterns and conventions to construct extremely complicated applications if you need to.
So the question that always comes up is how does this compare to the Angulars and the Embers and the Backbones and things of that nature?
Right, so it's quite a bit different than Backbone, which by the way is a very excellent, well-written framework. In fact, certain parts of Durandal are heavily inspired by Backbone, for example, our router and our event mechanism. But Backbone is really sort of a minimalistic framework, no data binding, a lot of manual wire up and things like that. So it's more similar to things like Ember and Angular, in that it's got data binding, it's got the notion of more of a built-in notion of sort of reusable components and things like this. In some ways, it's a matter of aesthetics, I guess. There are certain things about Ember and Angular that, you know, kind of personally rub me a little bit the wrong way. But in terms of features and capabilities, Durandal is pretty similar to those two. It just kind of embodies a different mentality, perhaps, about how you put the pieces together. You know, one of the big differences with Durandal is the way that the conventions work out. You very rarely end up actually invoking Durandal's APIs themselves. So if you're doing something in Angular, for example, you'll have to call the Angular API to create a controller or to create a module, and similar things in Ember. But in Durandal, you don't do that. You just create an AMD module. And it's done, because Durandal can basically, anything that's a module, it can display on the screen using its conventions. So you can create any JavaScript object you want, and if you have a corresponding HTML file, the system just understands those kind of relationships and that pattern, and so it can just display them. So there's a lot less boilerplate wire up just to tell the framework that, you know, such and such is a module and such is a view, or, you know, connect this particular view to this particular controller. So you don't really need to tell it those kind of things unless you're going to deviate from the conventions, which, you know, is fully supported as well. You can write your own conventions, or you can override things on a case-by-case basis. But, you know, 80 to 90% of the time, you don't need to do that. And so you have this very simple code. And I've even heard people say, you know, on Twitter, you know, wow, I forgot Durandal was there. And that's kind of the goal. That's really the goal and that we want to get to, because, you know, there's still some work to be done there. And, you know, we'll talk about the next gen stuff in a minute. But the next gen is just taking that kind of to the next level of, you know, let's just write plain JavaScript objects and regular HTML, and let's not have anything in there that looks like a framework at all, and let it just kind of be ambient. This ambient framework that assembles the pieces and stays out of your way is you know, really the goal. So that's something that I did a lot of work with on Calibre Micro, and so that idea, that sort of philosophy, is carried over into Durandal, and always trying to improve around that.
A common thing with, you know, very convention-oriented systems is they work great until they don't, and then you're not sure why, you know, convention's not being applied, and maybe it's just I misspelled something. You know, is there something in Durandal to help me figure out, you know, what's being wired up and why?
Sure. Well, first of all, in Durandal, there's very few conventions at all, a lot less than Calibre Micro, for example. The main convention is how views and modules get connected together. You can basically put the framework into debug mode, and it'll spit out into the console all kinds of things that it's doing. And it will tell you, you know, if you have a data binding error, for example, it won't just tell you what the error is, but it'll tell you exactly what module was involved and what view was involved. So you can very quickly find it. If it's trying to render a module on the screen, but it can't find the view for it, then it'll inject a view into the screen that's sort of a placeholder view that says, you know, hey, we tried to find this view. We looked for it here, but couldn't find it. So it tries to provide you with feedback around the places where you might make a mistake. It provides a lot of output through its internal logging so that you can see all the kinds of things it's doing internally. And that greatly helps, you know, you have to have some kind of diagnostic tool whenever you have a framework like this, especially if there's conventions involved. So we're trying to provide meaningful feedback about the internal processes that are going on, as well as giving meaningful errors and are augmenting the underlying errors with contextual information that helps you to locate the real problem easier.
So I think it's really interesting that Durandal stays out of the way, and looking at some of the features that are on your next gen list, it sounds like you're going to try to leverage some of the really newer specifications that are out there, like object.observe and web components, to stay more out of the way. But maybe you could just describe those four or five things you have listed in your next gen preview.
All right. So with the Kickstarter, we're doing a bunch of different things. I talked about the training we're doing. We want to produce. We're also trying to, of course, just it gives us a lot of flexibility to do, you know, more frequent releases of the current version of the framework, and to just do some improvements to our tooling around the framework. But that fourth goal is our next gen preview, which is sort of a reimagining of Durandal using technologies that are currently undergoing work in the specification groups that are mostly not available in browsers, or if they are available in browsers, they're behind a flag that you have to turn on. And a lot of the work we want to do in this area is, you know, there's a lot of reasons we're doing this. One is to just keep the framework relevant and moving forward. Another is to provide concrete feedback to the working groups that are, working to specify these things and get them in the browsers. If we have real frameworks and real apps built on top of them, then we can provide them with a lot of concrete information about whether their specifications are for something that can actually work. So we're doing all that. We're also doing it because a lot of these things will be faster when they're in the browser in the future. And so the more that Durandal can build on these native browser capabilities, the faster Durandal will be. And then, of course, what you asked about, too, is that last goal, which is to get the framework out of the way more and to simplify things more, to give developers more options, to make code cleaner and more modularized. You know, along those lines, one of the things we're doing is working on making our module system more flexible. So in the current version of Durandal, you have to use AMD modules. But in the next gen version that we're working on, you can use AMD modules, or you can use common JS modules, or you can use ES6 modules. And you can actually use them all together in the same project, and it just works. That wouldn't be a good idea, I don't think. But if you had some code that you got from one place and some code from another place and then your app code, and maybe they used a different module spec, then there wouldn't be any problem to use those together without altering them. So it just gives a lot more flexibility. I think most people will use the common JS modules with it because it's very simple and clean and doesn't require any kind of just-in-time transpiling like the ES6 modules do. But flexible modules. So we support three module systems. And in fact, the preview that I have right now, which I'll be demoing in the next day or so, supports those three module systems already. So web components, for those that aren't familiar, it's basically custom HTML elements. And there's a specification that's being worked on to enable developers to create custom elements and just a number of services or lifecycle issues around custom elements. And so Durandal is looking to leverage those features in order to provide improved declarative syntax and views. So things like our router, which you need to data bind to some portion of the screen to show the active page, we will have a router element. So that's a lot nicer, cleaner way to code. It's a lot more understandable when you're looking at it. All composition features will have a compose element. In fact, in the preview that I alluded to also, we have both of those implemented now. And it really makes reading the code easier and working with it easier, and actually simplifies some of the underlying implementations as well. And of course, on top of that, we'll have a thin layer that makes it easier for developers to build their own web components, leveraging features of Durandal. So that means not just building a custom element, but building a custom element that supports data binding and that supports templating and that, you know, has a reasonable lifecycle for the element and a number of other things. And in fact, that custom element layer is what our composition system and our router are built on now. So we'll provide that as an API, basically, so that developers can build their own components with those same features that our core components have.
That's pretty compelling because, you know, building a component sounds easy, but then with any kind of component I've ever built, then you run into all these kind of more difficult things with lifetime and events and how, you know, like, and so to have something that's more thought through from an application perspective sounds pretty useful.
Right. And there's some interesting things out there now doing that already too. X tags from Mozilla is one example that has kind of a layer on top of web components that adds a bunch of features that you usually need or want when you're building a custom component. So we're basically doing the same kind of thing, but it's more towards our aesthetic and our philosophy, which has a lot to do with composition and data binding and data driving your entire app. So, you know, you'll get data binding for free if you build, you know, your component using our API, and you'll get templating services for free and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, that just makes it really easy. It takes the pain out of building a custom element, and you don't feel like if you go down that road, then you're going to have to sacrifice data binding, for example. Because we want you to be able to take advantage of that, because when you write a component, you want to be able to take it, if it's actually a general component, like maybe like a rich text box component or something like that, you want to be able to take it from project to project, and being able to to have data binding and things like that makes it easier to move those things around, or being able to template it out and override the template and do different things like that on a per use basis makes it easier to reuse those. So that's some of the work we're doing around web components. There's kind of our core components we want to be nicer, and then there's the API for developers to create their own components. Object Observe is a third thing we're looking at, and that basically is an API that's coming to the browser that makes JavaScript objects natively observable. So you can basically call this API object.observe, pass it an object, and tell it what you want to track. And it will notify you when properties or arrays change, and it will tell you how they change. And so you can build a data binding system on top of this. And so what we're doing is our current version of Durandal is built on top of Knockout. So we're looking at what would it look like to build the same thing basically on top of object.observe. And of course, there's great benefits to that. Like I said before, it's good feedback to the working group that is creating the specifications for that, because we're a real community with people building real apps, and if the data binding doesn't work, we can hopefully get it fixed before we're all stuck with it. Because it would really be horrible if the browser had native observability, but nobody could use it, and we all had to implement our own stuff anyways, you know. So we want to provide that feedback on that API, and we want to try building stuff on top of that. But there's another really cool advantage as well, which is that once it is in there and native, it's gonna be fast. And I was looking at some of the testing that people had already done, and the object.observe polyfill that I'm using is already marginally faster than AngularJS's binding system. But if you turn on experimental JavaScript in Chrome, it'll turn on the native implementation, and then it's about 2 to 3 times faster than the AngularJS data binding system, for example. So again, really big performance improvements. And the thing is, it'll get, with the Durandal built on this, it will get faster as time goes on. You know, two things will basically happen by doing this with Durandal. One, over time, Durandal will get smaller as the polyfills that we use drop away and are replaced by actual native implementations. And Durandal will automatically get faster as well, because the native implementations will be faster than the polyfills. And like I said, there's already some people that have done some testing of that. Even the polyfills are a little bit better in some cases. But when you also turn on the native feature, you get massive performance improvements. And that's basically, those native APIs aren't even optimized yet. I mean, they're early implementations, so it'll probably be even greater performance improvements than that in the future. Those are the three big technologies that we're looking at building the next gen on. The new basic flexible modules, which uses the new loader API, a web components, and then object.observe. And then, of course, we're also looking to remove our dependencies on third-party libraries, such as jQuery, which you'll be able to use with the next gen, but you won't have to use it. Knockout, like I said, we'll be replacing that with native data binding support, and RequireJS will be replaced with the native loader API. So that's kind of the plan for next gen. And it's just right now it's an early preview. It's working pretty well. I'll have a video of that probably today's the 23rd, so I'm hoping to get it out tomorrow. I hope to get it out today, but I decided I wanted to squeeze one more feature in before I made the video. So I wanted to get animations in. So I'll have a video of that out probably tomorrow, and that's working on all these features I just mentioned. It uses CommonJS modules. It uses a router and a composition system based off of web components and actually based off of our custom element API. It uses object.observe for data binding, and it has no external dependencies other than the polyfills, which are built into it right now. So,
are the polyfills pretty straightforward to work with for these features?
I mean, they're like the polyfills are morphing because they're polyfilling a future API, and so you do have to keep on top of that if you're kind of working at the framework level where I'm working. For the most part, though, developers working with Durando won't see most of those APIs. They'll just kind of get the benefits of it because, for example, flexible modules, that's built on the ES6 loader, script loader spec. And you don't actually interact with that usually when you work with Durando. You just create your modules. So you say module.exports equals whatever if you're using CommonJS, for example. But you don't actually mess with the loader API unless you want to do something kind of abnormal. With object.observe, for your normal JavaScript objects, you never call that API. It's happening behind the scenes. When we bind your module code with your HTML template, we do all the observation and hook all that up basically. So you don't see that unless you're using the API to do a special type of property that needs to raise custom notifications about when it's changing or something like that. There's an API for that. It's a little bit rough around the edges, in my opinion. But that's one of the reasons that we want to, you know, build stuff with this and then go poke and prod the people working on it to say, hey, you know, we can do better than this. And here's some scenarios you can look at where it's not quite ideal. But the polyfills are, like I said, mostly you don't see a lot of them. For example, one you don't see is like DOM token list, and you don't see the mutation observers, which are things that most people don't know about at all. And actually, modern browsers have those implemented, but most people don't know they're there because they're really four frameworks. You know, the mutation observers, they notify you when changes happen in the DOM, and that's something you're not going to work with explicitly, but the custom element polyfill is built on it so that it can support the element lifecycle. So, for example, when you create a custom element, you can get called back when your element is removed from the DOM. Well, how do we do that? Well, the DOM mutation observer capability, it lets us get notified when that happens, and then we can push that to you in a nicer way. So you don't have to worry about that API. All you do is implement your callback on your custom element, and we make sure you get called, basically.
Gotcha.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting stuff that, unless you really dig down deep, you don't even know is there. Like some of those polyfills I just mentioned, which most people probably never have heard of, but they're there. They're in modern browsers now, and they can be polyfilled a little bit in slightly older browsers. But their framework for sort of building some of the other polyfills on, like web components, which are partially implemented in certain browsers, but you can polyfill it by, you know, working on top of the DOM mutation observers and things like that. So,
gotcha. I don't know if I should ask this question or not, but I was trying to picture how an object.observe polyfill would work. Basically, when you're operating in an environment where that is not native, there's got to be some sort of snapshot routine that's running at the end of every, I don't know, tick or event turn, right?
Yeah, it actually, the polyfill is actually implemented very similar to the way that Angular's internal binding system works. Mm. It essentially does dirty tracking on objects, and it has a tick, and it has certain points in time also that it specifically will explicitly run, like after event handlers and things like that. So the actual implementation of that is very similar to the way the Angular system is. What's nice, of course, about it is that if you're just looking for observability, it's isolated. You know, it's a polyfill that is just object observability, and it's in line with the future specifications, so you can build on that. And, you know, say you didn't want to use Angular and you didn't want to use Durando and you didn't want to use any of these frameworks, but you did really want some observability. Well, now you can take that, just that one piece, and use it. And so that's great. When I looked at Angular, I really wished that part of Angular was broken out separate. Because honestly, I probably would have built Durandal on top of that if it had been constructed that way. But it wasn't. But this object observed polyfill is that, basically. But it has the added benefit of complying with the specification so that when it appears in browsers natively, there's no changes to Durandal under the covers. It just all of a sudden it uses the native functionality. But the polyfill implementation does a number of tricksy things to dirty track and to check at, you know, at points in time when it thinks that it should check, and to do things at regular intervals and things like that. And you can, much like in Angular, where you can tell it to process, you can do the same thing with object.observe, but you shouldn't ever see that because Durandal is doing it basically when it needs to. And that operation is basically a no op when it actually is native.
Gotcha. This is making sense now. That's good.
Yeah, it's really cool. I mean, you can check it out on GitHub. I think I even have a link to it in... No, actually, I have a link to Adi Osmani's blog on Object Observe. It's in the Kickstarter page, and he does a really great presentation. And I think he's on the Ember team. But a lot of people are looking at these polyfills. I wouldn't doubt if Angular and Ember both end up being worked on top of this same polyfill and then within the next year or so. I wouldn't really be too surprised, to be honest.
It would make a lot of sense. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. So we want to do the same thing, and there's a lot of benefits for doing that. So
you would also mention tooling improvements. What kind of tooling do you have in mind?
Right. So currently we have a basic build tool called Wayland, which is just for optimizing your single page apps. It basically is a wrapper around the Require.js optimizer, but it knows a little bit more about Durandal, so it can automate things a little bit nicer for you. So we'd like to just make some improvements to that, do another version of that, covering more scenarios. We would also like to have official Grunt support. Grunt is an extremely popular build tool for JavaScript apps. There's some community contributions and unofficial stuff floating around, but we want to basically bring that into the project, make sure it's feature complete in a way that's compatible with our Wayland tool, so that you can have the same feature fidelity, basically, for building Durandal apps between the two. So we want to build that. And the third tooling piece we want to build, which is one I'm really, really excited about and that I've wanted to build for a long time but just haven't been able to spare the time to do it, is a live update of views. Talked about how Durandal understands the relationship between modules and views, and it can put them together by convention. So it has this kind of internal knowledge base about how all these pieces are put together. And there's a very specific composition lifecycle around everything that's enforced by the framework. So the benefit of all that, besides it being nice for application developers, is that you can build some tooling that understands that as well. The idea being that if you're working on an HTML view and you write some HTML, whenever you save that HTML file, we would like to be able to push that to the browser and update that view or that view fragment in place without affecting any other aspect of your application. It's not terribly hard to do because, like I said, Durandal already has this composition system and this composition lifecycle, and it already has built into it the notion of swapping views out over top of modules and things like that. So all we need to do basically is patch that through so that we can know when you change something on your local file system, and we can just basically bring it in, instantiate it, and re-sort of execute the lifecycle over that new view. And I just think that'll be a tremendous productivity improvement. You could just keep your browser open, and you'll have to refresh much less often. Because when you're typically working on a screen, you know, you might mess with the HTML for a while. So it's nice if you can actually have the live app up and running and see those changes as you're making them in the view. And of course, we'll do some other things like auto refresh when you change your JavaScript code. I didn't want to, at this point in time, go down the path of live updating of code because that's a lot more complicated. I do have some ideas about it, but I'm hesitant to commit to doing it because it's a much more risky endeavor and fraught with a lot more edge cases that can make things go horribly wrong. But ultimately, we want to get to a point where you load a Durandal app and it's an empty HTML page, and then you just start writing code. And as you write code and as you create views, things just start appearing, such that the browser becomes your design tool, basically, or half of your design tool, the other half being your code editor, but not needing any kind of fancy external preview tooling or anything like that, but the browser actually becomes the design surface. So we want to start moving in that direction, and the live update of views is an important first step that actually makes a pretty big difference for people's developer experience. So that's something that, if the Kickstarter succeeds, we'll be building that in the next, you know, most of the tooling will be done in the first half of 2014. So back to Kickstarter, because I really want to build that. And you want to have it.
Yeah, that would be fantastic.
So mentioning Kickstarter, I think we mentioned some of the rewards. I don't think we talked about the actual specific like levels people can donate at and stuff, right?
Right. So the Kickstarter is there's everything from pledging at the $15 level, which gets you basically that gets you listed on the site as a backer, but also gets you that first video training course. So it's actually a really great deal, because you're not going to find a whole lot of video training materials anyways that you can buy for $15. You will find some, but basically it's a good deal on some really good training. So That's at $15. That's kind of the first thing you get. But it goes up from there, and it goes all the way up to $6,000, which is a conference. Basically, I'll come to your city, and you invite as many people as you want, and we'll do a full day, a conference, where we, 8 hours, 8-10 hours of training, where we build Durandal apps. And so that's kind of like at the upper end. If you're a community organizer or a company that wants to invest in the community, you know, that's at the upper end. And everywhere in the middle, there's virtual conference opportunities, there's marketing opportunities. For example, if you're a consultant and you do a lot of Durandal development and you want people to know that you're available for that, there's a consultant tier where you get, you know, all the training, you get t-shirts, you get insider access to everything I'm doing, plus you get listed in an official consulting directory. So when people go to durandaljs.com, you know, they'll see that there's a consultants directory there, and they'll be able to find your company and get in touch with you. So there's this different marketing opportunities like that focused around Durandal and community and learning and so on and so forth, that people can back at those different levels. And I tried to, you know, pump a lot of value into it, which is why, you know, at the bottom few levels, you straight away get the video training materials, and you get it for cheaper than you would be able to buy it anyways. So it's sort of like a, you know, by backing the project, you basically get a early access, heavily discounted version of it. You know, it's like a pre-order, but it helps the project out by backing now as to waiting until the whole series is released and then buying it the way everybody else will, basically. So lots of different options there, just depending on whether you're an individual, a company, a consultant, or a group of consultants, or a community organizer, or whatnot. So lots of different levels, different rewards. You know, they kind of build on each other. So at the top, at the higher levels, you get everything. At the lower levels, you know, if you back what I call an MVP, you get all three training courses, you get a T-shirt, you get GitHub access to the next gen preview before it's public. You get access to the private blog, which I'm going to be writing on every week about what I'm working on, but also about these polyfills and these new technologies. And so it's a great educational kind of buy-in for people as well, because we'll be talking about Object Observe and web components and how those standards are changing and what we're involved with the groups on that, and so on and so forth. You know, so there's a lot of different opportunities to learn and get some materials that are just quite heavily useful as a developer or as a company.
Well, Rob, I hope you have fantastic success with this so that you can work on it as much as you want, because you do make the world a better place.
Thank you.
You really do. Any last comments, any last words, anything else exciting? I mean, it just is the Kickstarter, I think. So.
Yeah, I'm just thankful to you guys having me on the show and letting me share this. I hope everybody will check out the Kickstarter. There's some cool videos up there showing one of the training apps that we'll build, which I think is really neat. And like I said, in the next day or so, we'll have the video demoing the next-gen version. And so I think that'll actually be a how-to video. I'll actually build a Hello World app, so you'll kind of see that. So I think there's a lot of cool stuff to check out on the Kickstarter site. And I just, if you use open source, if you've never contributed financially to an open source project, just think about all the all the benefits that if you're a web developer, you're using some kind of open source probably. And just think about what your life would be like without that. And as you're thinking about that, drop a few bucks into the Kickstarter pot. And because it does make a huge difference. And, you know, the idea behind crowdfunding is, you know, I want to try and deliver a maximum of value to the entire community. And if a lot of people are just willing to donate a little bit, you get some really nice rewards out of it, but it keeps it really cheap for everybody else. And a lot of people can, you know, a lot of people can benefit. So one person doesn't have to drop, you know, $100,000 in, you know, a few thousand people can drop, you know, 10 or 20 bucks in or whatever. And it works out with more people getting more free stuff, you know, in the long run.
Very good. Well, we will spread the word, but thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
Yep. Thanks a bunch, Rob.
And thanks everybody for listening.